Welcome back to Midpoint, friends, on this January 14th, 2026. I'm your host, Shelley Reback. It has certainly been a difficult and frightening start to the new year around the country. In Minnesota, Portland, and elsewhere, I won't review the parade of horribles we've recently been faced with in this country, except to say, I hope that you are following and paying deep attention to the national news. I hope you are talking about the lawless actions of our federal government with your friends and family and in your circle of influence. And I hope you are doing everything you can to keep your people safe and to make your feelings known to the powers that be. But here on Midpoint, we like to keep things focused on Florida. Lord knows we have problems here too, of the homegrown variety, and in some cases they overlap with the issues coming out of Washington. One of those issues is the view on children's vaccines. There have recently been new guidelines on children's vaccines coming out of Washington and new guidelines coming out of Tallahassee, and that is going to be our main topic of the day. In a few moments, after our Florida News Nuggets, we will be hearing from Dr. Jennifer Takagishi. She is the John and Elise Price Endowed Chair in Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine, the Division Chief, General Academic Pediatrics, and Professor of Pediatrics at the USF Morsani College of Medicine. And we are very lucky to have her with us in the WMNF studios. But first, a look at some Florida news. These comments are, of course, my own alone and may not represent the views of WMNF, the Nation B. Stubblefield Foundation, which holds our FCC license, or my guests. As you may know, the Florida legislature opened its regular session yesterday, putting us all in danger of the ongoing deluge of bad laws that has been the hallmark of the last quarter century of Republican-controlled lawmaking in Tallahassee. Let's see what they're up to now already, shall we? Well, state lawmakers in Florida again resurrected two very dangerous bills. One that could lead to a complete abortion ban, and another that would protect a giant mining corporation from environmental lawsuits. The first bill would give fetuses some of the same legal rights as living children, and it would further cement into law a legal theory known as fetal personhood that conservative legal groups want to use to cut off all access to abortion. House Bill 663 and Senate Bill 164 would create civil liability for the wrongful death of an unborn child. These bills are being considered in the current session, and if reproductive rights are important to you, please pay attention to their progress and let your legislators know how you feel about this. Second, House Bill 167 would help fertilizer giant Mosaic Corporation fend off lawsuits related to radioactive contamination left behind in the company's former phosphate mines. Now, you'll recall that in 2023, Mosaic was granted permission by the legislature to study the use of phosphogypsum, a radioactive, carcinogenic, and toxic fertilizer byproduct for paving roads in Florida. And they've already employed that product on roads on Mosaic-owned land. Now they want to be relieved of all liability for also leaving contamination in their former phosphate mines. Again, if this chafes you, you know what you must do. Contact your state senators. Oh, except all of you residents of State Senate District 14, who are still without representation in that district since Jay Collins left his seat to become lieutenant governor. And because DeSantis failed to set a special election in a timely manner, you residents of District 14 still have no one to call who actually represents you. But now, finally, the special election for State Senate representation in District 14 is scheduled for March 24th, and the deadline to register to vote in that election is February 23rd, 2026. The field is set with Republican Josie Tomcow, who was facing term limits in the Florida House and who will resign from her House District 51 seat, which is centered in Polk County. Tomko, the Republican, has been endorsed, of course, by all Republicans, such as Congresswoman Laura Lee, who just recently voted against the bipartisan U.S. House bill to revive the health care subsidies that would have lowered the cost of your health care, the health care for all Americans in Florida, including her constituents. Josie Tomko's Democratic opponent is Brian Nathan. He's a Navy veteran, an electrician, and is active with his union for electrical workers. If you live in District 14, this is your chance to make your mark on the Florida legislature. Please don't waste it. Register to vote by February 23rd and vote in the March 24th election. Now, speaking of Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins, after months of speculation, Collins on Monday announced he will run for governor this year, setting up a big Republican primary fight against Trump's preferred candidate, Congressman Byron Donalds, the former State House Speaker Paul Renner, and investment firm CEO James Fishback, and now Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins. It sure seems like Jay Collins is DeSantis's preferred candidate, but it remains to be seen if DeSantis has any juice left now that he is a lame duck politician. I'd love to be able to discuss the bill filed that requires state universities and colleges in Florida to rename roadways or portions of their roads to honor Charlie Kirk. And it requires funds to be withheld from any school that fails to do so. But we don't have time for such foolishness. Let me sum up with a segue to our topic of the day. Florida is also actively considering legislation, notably House Bill 917 and Senate Bill 1756, aimed at eliminating or restricting vaccine mandates. This is driven by Governor DeSantis and Surgeon General Latipo's push for what they call medical freedom, which includes ending all school immunization requirements for certain diseases and prohibiting discrimination based on vaccination status. To discuss all of these developments regarding vaccines with us is Dr. Jennifer Takagishi. She is the John and Elise Price Endowed Chair in Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine, Division Chief, General Academic Pediatrics, and Professor of Pediatrics at the USF Morsani College of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Takagishi.
Well, welcome to you, and thank you so much for inviting me to speak today.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you. All right, where to begin? Let's start with the recent changes to the historical vaccination guidelines by the CDC, and then later we'll talk about Florida. So what has changed so far in these new CDC guidelines for childhood vaccinations?
Sure. The CDC has actually recommended that we go from 17 vaccines down to 11 diseases that we are protecting against. So they are removing ones such as hepatitis B and A. They are removing the vaccine
for rotavirus,
For rotavirus, yeah. And decreasing HPV down to one. They're also
from two, yeah.
Yeah, from two.
The protocol was two. Yes. And meningococcal disease, however you say that.
I'm not a,
thank
disease.
God I couldn't go to medical school because, of course, I couldn't do math. But, yeah, how do you say that?
Meningococcal disease, there's actually two different vaccines for that as well. So
And COVID-19, they're recommending that kids don't need that, right?
And the flu
And the flu. Now, they're changing the recommendation, not even recommendation, the guidelines for administering all of these vaccines. And the protocol now is they're moving to what they're calling a shared clinical decision-making category, which is basically saying instead of doctors telling the parents of their patients that their kids need these vaccines, they're basically saying parents have the responsibility to discuss this with the physician. The physician has the responsibility to take the parents' concerns into account and basically do what the parent wants, right?
The idea is that really we've been doing this all along, just to a more a longer extent. So we have always talked to our families about what vaccines are available, which diseases that we are protecting them against, but that instead of saying these are the vaccines and most of our families agreeing without a lot of discussion, they want us to have a lot longer discussions, particularly for families that have a lot of questions. And we're against paternalism, but we also have spent a lot of time and energy with science and education to learn which ones are safe and which ones are the healthiest for your children. And we would like to think that you trust that relationship that we have built with you.
Well, you know, you're an academic physician. One of the other considerations about this is, frankly, how much time it takes to spend with parents to discuss the vaccinations. Physicians out in private practice, you know, in these practices owned by private equity firms, for example, you know, they have, what, maybe 15 minutes with a patient? And lately, you know, parents have a lot of questions about these vaccines. I don't see these insurance companies, you know, changing the time guidelines that they have expected physicians to adhere to make it through a day full of patients, right? That's another issue.
Yeah, the amount of time that is spent is going to be taken up by vaccines, and we won't have as much time to spend talking about any of the other issues that your family may have to keep your child healthy and safe. So asking families to do some of the research on some of the websites that have been shown to be accurate, such as the American Academy of Pediatrics has one, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has a lot of work on this. And so families can look at websites that we consider to be accurate and do some work in advance so that those conversations can be very meaningful.
Okay, well, that's good advice. You know, there have been very divergent views between the CDC's new guidelines and a lot of the physicians' professional organizations, haven't there? Like the American Academy of Physicians, or is it the American Academy of Pediatrics? Tell us about that.
Sure. So I'm actually the vice president of our Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and we and a lot of other medical organizations have looked at this vaccine schedule and said, this isn't safe and healthy, not just for our children, but for the people around them as well, who may also be vulnerable to these diseases. And there's been no evidence to say that these vaccines should be removed from the schedule. So we are still strongly recommending that all of them remain available to our families and that they get them to keep their children and their families safe and healthy.
And that's the consensus position of the professional organizations of physicians and
Correct.
Pediatricians,
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Yeah, because it's not just your kid may get sick. It's that, you know, your kid may get sick and be around people who are immunocompromised or elderly who could get sick much more easily, or even healthcare professionals who would be exposed to them if they get so sick that they need to see a doctor or even, God forbid, go to a hospital, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's not just them. There's also, if you think about all these children going to school, the school educators are against this as well.
Yeah, teachers, right.
Teachers,
yeah.
They don't want to be exposed. There are also people who can't get vaccines, whether they're too young or something, you know, like that. For example, I had a two-week-old in my practice who died of whooping cough.
Oh, goodness.
Too young to have gotten even the whooping cough vaccine. So somebody around him gave it to him.
Oh, wow.
And tragically, you know, died from that. And families don't always want to hear not just getting sick, but actually dying from these diseases. But that's the reality, and we need to be realistic about the fact that there is a reason we have all these vaccines.
And we've heard the news about, you know, epidemics of diseases that we had long thought were eradicated, like the measles epidemic, for example, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, my mother actually reminds me that she almost died from the measles because she was alive before that vaccine had come out, and now people have refused it to the point that we as a country will probably lose our, we were considered eradicated in 2000 from measles, and we will probably lose that status in the past year, we had more measles than we had in 30 years.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to me that that's even a discussion, unfortunately.
And people are resistant to hearing the fact that you can die of measles.
You can die of a lot of things. And measles is extremely contagious. Mm-hmm. If one person gets it, they could give it to 12 other people who then continue to spread it as well. And we've got it in many, many states. And you need 95% of the population to be immune to it in order to keep it under wraps, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, these diseases haven't gone away. They've just kind of hidden in the shadows. And because we've been so successful with vaccines, we haven't seen a lot of them in so long that now the diseases are able to come back and they're all ready to go. Same thing with whooping cough. We're seeing huge surges in whooping cough, surges in the flu. This year has so far been a very bad flu. Flu year. We've had 9 children already this year have died from the flu.
But I also think that if I read this correctly, that, mm-hmm. you know, the flu changes from year to year.
Yes.
So much that it's often difficult to predict what you need to be protected against. And this year in particular, the flu vaccine was not, you know, as effective as the people who developed it would have hoped, right? Against the strain that happened to be circulating this year, right?
Yeah, there is a new variant of the influenza A that is circulating out there, but it still decreases your risk of getting the flu or getting still such a bad version. And there's also the other component, which is the influenza B part, which we often see 2 stages of the flu. Sometimes we'll see A and then B. And so we still do recommend you get the flu vaccine, but you know, we may not be as protected against that particular variant as we wish we were.
Yeah, but that's an every year thing.
Absolutely.
That they try to their best to predict, you know, which strain is going to be circulating the most. Right. But right. sometimes
there's a reason that these diseases have been around so long is that they have learned to adapt. And we adapt as fast as we can to them. But some have really not adapted much in many, many years. And that's the advantage that we have of giving these continued vaccines is that we can keep them at bay before they change a lot.
Like measles, for
exactly.
example.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Listeners, if you have questions about vaccinations, you can call us at 813-239-9663 and you can speak with our expert, Dr. Takagishi. But I'm going to tell you to keep your questions brief and succinct. We have a lot to get to today. So if you do go on and on, I will cut you off. I am the queen of the phone board. So give us a call at 813-239-9663 if you do have questions. And, you know, we may take them up. All right. So in these discussions between parents and their doctors about whether to get vaccines, about scheduling vaccines for kids, you know, what kind of criteria are we talking about that need to be considered in determining these vaccine recommendations, especially for high-risk groups, like, you know, kids with pre-existing conditions or something that are challenging?
Sure. So we have looked very hard at when we should give vaccines, how many they need, what your disease state is. So it includes children who were born prematurely, children who are immunocompromised, but healthy children too can get any of these diseases. So we start from birth. Well, we traditionally have recommended the hepatitis B vaccine and added the RSV monoclonal antibody recently because hepatitis B can cause liver disease and cancer. RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, puts so many children in the hospital every year. So we start with those two, and then, you know, at 2 months we start, you know, worrying about things like whooping cough, polio, the H flu meningitis shot, the pneumococcal shot, really trying to keep kids healthy because before them we saw so many children getting sick. And so waiting to see, oh, well, maybe if we wait a few months, you know, their immune systems will be better. Their immune systems are fine from day one. They can accept all these vaccines just fine, and they're actually more at risk not getting them than they are being exposed to the small amount of vaccine components.
I've got some emails here I want to share with you, Dr. Takagishi. Okay. I have one from, this is a text from 2299 who says, I'm not against vaccines, but patients and families have a right to informed consent. I don't think anybody disagrees with that here, right?
No, and you actually sign a form to say that you're willing to accept the vaccines.
Okay, somebody wants to ask you about the tetanus vaccine and how tetanus is contracted.
So you can get it from a rusty nail, for example. So I had a child recently who had stepped on a nail and was not up to date on his vaccine. And so we made sure he got it so that he didn't get tetanus.
Okay, but tetanus is not like a routine vaccine.
Yes, it is. The diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, the DTaP, is in there. And then at 11, you get the Tdap, which is tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis.
Okay.
And then every 10 years, you are recommended to get updates of tetanus, the Tdap, because your immunity can wane over time to those.
So if you said at 11, you get that Tdap vaccine.
Correct. 11 to 14.
11 to 14. So if you get that then, and you step on a rusty nail between the ages of the next 10 years, 11 and 21, say, are you pretty much protected?
You should be protected. They may decide if it's pushing that 10 years to give it.
Like a booster?
As a booster, but that should keep you pretty well protected.
Okay. I've got a call from James in Hudson. I'm going to bring you into the air. James, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question for your guest real quick.
Yep.
It pertains to vaccines in children. All right. So real quick scenario. 11-month-old, 5 days away from its first birthday, goes to the doctor, gets the MMR shot. Next day, double ear infection, fever, and before that, the child was talkative, making eye contact, laughing, like just a perfect baby. After the MMR, stops talking, stops laughing, doesn't make eye contact. 2 years later, gets diagnosed with autism. Absolutely no coincidence whatsoever.
Okay, let's let our expert, Dr. Takagishi, respond to your question, James. Thanks a lot for calling in. We appreciate it. Okay, Dr. Takagishi, how do you respond to James's scenario?
Yeah, we start doing the MMR at a year of age. We don't give it before that. So more likely than not, whatever illness he had had the few days before may have been what has caused him to have some kind of damage potentially. But there have been study after study, hundreds of thousands of children, where we have looked at any link between MMR and autism, and it has been proven over and over again that there is no link between them. You know, we see children who are starting to talk, and it's usually around 1 year old. So that being one of the hallmark disease components of autism is often social issues. People put the fact that they're associated at the same time frame as causation, and there is no proof of causation.
So, yeah, causation or correlation doesn't necessarily mean causation,
correct,
right?
Correct.
Yeah, it just so happens that you get the vaccine and the development of verbal ability, more sophisticated verbal ability and social interaction at the same age, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah.
And so that's why a lot of people believe that the two or that the vaccine caused any delays or problems later, challenges later that people diagnose as autism.
Correct.
But not necessarily, huh?
That is correct.
Hmm. Okay. One of the things I do want to talk about before we move into what's happening in Florida around vaccines is the CDC guidelines are supposedly enacted via presidential directive to align the United States childhood schedule with the practices of other developed nations. And specifically, they cite Denmark as a model for the kind of vaccine treatment that the CDC is now newly recommending. I want to talk about that. And whether it makes sense for the United States to adopt the same kind of vaccine protocols that a country like Denmark has. Can we talk about that?
I'm happy to talk about that. And it's really not a fair comparison. A lot of the countries, although they are developed as we are significantly smaller. They also often have single-payer health systems through the government.
And yeah, so, like universal health care for exactly, their population.
Exactly. Whereas
as Denmark does.
Exactly. We have all kinds of versions of health insurance from the government, whether it's federal or state. Some people have none at all. Some people have insurance that only covers certain things that they have. And so to say that we as extremely large country with a large population of many, many different, we're the melting pot, right? So we have all kinds of
at least today, at least this week.
True. But currently we are still a melting pot with lots of different people. And to compare us to a small country where there's a lot more similarity is just wrong. It's just not a fair comparison at all. We need to keep our population safe and not that of other countries.
Yeah, to be more specific about Denmark, Denmark's vaccine policy is essentially more minimalist than the historical United States policy that we've been talking about with the 17 recommended vaccines. And Denmark routinely still recommends vaccines. Mm-hmm. They just recommend them against 10 diseases instead of 17 or 18, and Danish children typically receive their first vaccines at 3 months of age. In contrast, the United States children traditionally receive several vaccines, including the first hepatitis B dose, as you mentioned, within the first 24 hours of birth. And Denmark generally spaces their vaccines more widely than the United States schedule. So that's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And just to be clear about what you were saying, Denmark has a socialized system of health care, and they ensure universal free health care. So this, I would imagine, allows them to manage diseases like, a rotavirus through treatment rather than through universal prevention. Mm-hmm. So if a kid gets a rotavirus, for example, they can get on public transportation, easily get to their doctor, who's available for free, and get treatment rather than rely on a vaccine to not get the disease in the first place. That's one of the things, right?
That's true, but we still recommend prevention over treatment. If you can avoid getting rotavirus in the first place, why would you not? Mm. And I used to take care of children with rotavirus. That vaccine came out after I was already in practice. And we had kids in the hospital for days with high fever, vomiting, diarrhea. They were on IV fluids because they couldn't tolerate any food going into their system. So why would you want that hospitalization, that risk of severe illness, when you can prevent it with a liquid in your mouth at 2 months and 4 months and 6 months at most, depending on the version of the vaccine? Mm-hmm. Like that, to me, that's the whole point of vaccines, is to prevent the disease in the first place, mm-hmm, rather than having to treat it later.
Well, of course, God forbid any kid has a rotavirus that requires hospitalization. That would be the protocol, whether you're in the U.S. or you're in Denmark. That kid would be in a hospital. But one of the other reasons why Denmark's vaccine system works for them, mm-hmm, and may not work for us, mm-hmm, here in the United States is because Denmark has very generous sick leave and parental leave policies. So that allows Danish families to stay home and take care of their sick children at home, mm-hmm, without financial loss and without losing their job if they don't show up. And, without having to send a sick kid to school, yeah, right? Yeah, so that's a very big difference. We do not have that kind of, social support that a country, democratic socialist country like Denmark has, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Our parental leave policies are very limited. Some of our families have no benefits at all, including health insurance. We have a lot of families who have none. And so they are reliant upon vaccine for children's or other ways to maybe get health care, or they have to go to an urgent care or an emergency room for their care, running up huge bills, which is another area of significant concern for families as well, that they can't afford the health care.
Yeah. So, you know, that's one of the things when we talk about if you want effective health care for children, you know, then family leave policies are something else to consider besides just vaccinations. But you're here to talk about vaccinations. So let's stick with that. Well, just to be clear on what I said about the family leave policy, you know, there are some of these diseases that our U.S. kids get vaccinated for that are not necessarily life-threatening, like chickenpox, right?
100 people a year used to die from the chickenpox before the vaccine came out. And a lot did there were still a lot of hospitalizations, particularly in people who are immunocompromised. And it decreases your risk of getting shingles later, which as an adult is painful.
Yes, that's horrible.
Disease. So even though we think of it as a mild childhood illness, and back in the day we had chickenpox parties where everybody came together, but for those people who got pneumonia or meningitis or got a bacterial infection from that, from scratching so much from that disease, it was actually a very difficult disease to get through.
Okay. All right. Well, but if your kid did get chickenpox and you had good family leave policies, you could take care of them at home.
And
hopefully, you know,
put the calamine lotion on and oven mitts on their hands so they didn't scratch.
Exactly. That was my experience. It shows you my age. But so the 2026 revision by the Department of Health and Human Services, the United States has moved to align more closely with Denmark's kind of leaner vaccine model.
Correct.
And this would include like categorizing certain previously universal vaccines like flu, COVID-19, hepatitis A, as part of this shared clinical decision-making option rather than as a routine requirement for all children, and reducing the number of core recommended childhood vaccines, as we've said, from 17 down to the Danish level of approximately 10 or 11. That's where we're at now with regard to U.S. policy without all of the fundamental support systems that exist in the Danish healthcare model that we do not have. And in fact, that our Republican-controlled administration, federal administration, and state administration oppose, like universal health care, like even something like increasing the subsidies for purchasing health insurance. You know, these are things that are opposed by the same people who have now, you know, promulgated these new guidelines be consistent, more consistent with the Danish policy. You know, that worries me.
Worries me a lot, too. I have families who have already told me they will not be able to come back to my practice because they will not have health insurance. They cannot afford it. I had a family the other day that said they were spending $500 every month and still got bills for labs and visits, et cetera, so they were going to, they call it going bare. They were not going to have health insurance, and even though their child has a disease that we need to follow and monitor, they're not going to be able to afford it.
Yeah. All right. We have a email here from one of our listeners who says, my son was in the hospital for nearly a week with RSV. We nearly lost him.
Yeah, I am so, so sorry. I don't know if he had received the RSV monoclonal antibody or not, but RSV is a very, very a difficult disease to treat and to take care of because we don't have any, there's no antibiotic that's going to fix this. So you're giving oxygen, you're giving, you know, fluids if they can't take it in. They're often in the hospital, sometimes in the intensive care units, or unfortunately sometimes even dying from it, particularly those vulnerable like our prematurely born infants. So I'm so sorry for your hospitalization. I'm glad he did not.
Yeah. Glad he survived.
Yes,
that.
Exactly.
Okay, I have Jeff in St. Pete. Jeff, you're on the line. You're on the air.
Hey, good show. I just wanted to say that when I was a child and I went to kindergarten, my mom would take us to the health department, and we had to get shots required to attend school.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Jeff, because that's one of the big things that we're going to talk about now when we talk about Florida's position on vaccines. Florida is trying to change the requirement that kids be vaccinated before they attend public schools. Yeah. Now, you were vaccinated, right, Jeff, before you attended public school?
Oh, yeah. I had to go to pre-kindergarten or whatever that was.
Yep. And do you have a position on whether that was a good idea or a bad idea or a good thing to do or a bad thing to do?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
What's your position, Jeff?
Hey, I was in the Air Force 14 years.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you. And every place I went, I had to take shots for different diseases might be I could catch in different countries.
And are you supportive of that policy that you had to do that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. Yes, well, thank you for calling in and giving us your experience. Appreciate that, Jeff. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in. Okay, so a couple things before we move off the federal thing on vaccines. I want to mention that there are some parents who are worried about additives to vaccines, not so much the vaccines themselves, but, you know, whether these additives cause problems for their children later on in life. One of the things in prepping for this show that I learned about was a program called Vaccines for Children. This is a federal program where you can discuss your preferences for specific formulations of vaccines. For example, like a preservative-free single-dose vial of vaccine. You can discuss that with your provider, your physician, your pediatrician. And if your doctor participates in this program and if your doctor agrees to your request, the doctor then can order this preservative-free single-dose vaccine vial through their established medical supply chains or through the Vaccines for Children program if they're an enrolled member in that program and if you qualify for that program. And then your doctor has to put you on a very strict schedule for administering the vaccine because they have no preservatives. So as soon as they come in, you got to get to your doctor's office and have this vaccine administrated. Do you know whether that program's going to continue now?
We assume so. We are being told that, yes, the Vaccine for Children's program, which provides vaccines for low-income families, has been around for a long time. We're not being told that it is going to be removed. We use it a lot in our practice at all. About 85% of our children receive their vaccines through it. So it would be devastating if it was removed. Even within that idea of all these single-dose vaccines, there are very few actually that can be separated. For example, the measles, mumps, rubella cannot. You have to get it as a combined vaccine. And the preservatives are extremely small amounts, and they're really designed to allow you to have more time to receive that vaccine. Many years ago, for example, hepatitis B had more mercury in it than was considered. The preservative was called thimerosal, and so it was removed from the market, reformulated so that there are different ways to preserve it. But it is much better for families to have that opportunity to keep the vaccine around longer than it is to do the single dose. It just takes a lot more work.
And it really makes it difficult for the physician's practice, too.
Absolutely.
Because without a preservative, people have to come in immediately. They have to fit them into the schedule, etc. But let me just say, you can review the full ingredient lists for all FDA-approved vaccines on the official FDA website, if that's something that concerns you. Better that you get the vaccine.
Absolutely.
Than that way, then you just reject the vaccine altogether. Is that your position?
Absolutely. Whatever we can do to help you remain vaccinated.
Okay. Let me take one more call. I have John and Lutz on the air. John, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I just thought I'd share my own experience.
If you make it brief.
Yeah, I'm glad that we have a chickenpox vaccine now, because as a kid, my brothers and I my parents had us take a bath with our cousin who was infected with chicken pox so that we would all get it and get over it. And it was the most horrible itching all over imaginable. And I've got scars to this day because of it. So I'm very glad there's a vaccine.
Well, thanks for calling in, John. I had a similar experience when I was a kid because I was a kid before the vaccine existed. Thanks for calling in with your experience. We appreciate you listening.
Thank you.
I want to talk about Florida now.
Okay.
Okay. These two Florida bills, Senate Bill 1756 and House Bill 917, propose broad changes in vaccine policy for Florida. For example, the bills would prohibit discrimination against patients based on their vaccination status. That means nobody can be denied being admitted to public school or to any places based on the fact that they have not been vaccinated. That's the presumption of this particular policy. Also, the bills would require healthcare providers to get signed consent forms from parents for childhood vaccinations detailing the risks and benefits of vaccines. Do we do that now?
We basically do that now. We show them the vaccine information sheets. We tell them what vaccines we're giving. We have them sign, you know, to say that they're getting the vaccines. They may do so at the very beginning of the visit or once the administrator gives it to them, but yeah, we already do that, so that's not really a change.
Do they have to sign something?
They usually have to sign something that says they want vaccines.
Okay, so that may not be a change. Also, the policy would allow, or the law, would allow pharmacists to dispense ivermectin without a prescription. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, there's very few times for which, or diseases for which ivermectin is appropriate, and to have a pharmacist not know the disease that you're going to be giving it for does not make sense.
Okay, so yeah, ivermectin, that was the like horse medicine that was touted by a number of Trump supporting physicians early in the COVID, not even early, throughout the COVID.
Not useful.
Not useful. Okay, well, this would allow pharmacists to dispense it without an ivermectin, to dispense ivermectin without a prescription. So, like, okay, you want to spend your money on it, I guess, right?
I can't give any good reason to do that.
Okay. And the law would also expand exemptions for conscience-based refusal of health exams or immunizations. Expand exemptions for conscience, I guess, you know, like... It gives people an out if they don't want their kids vaccinated, but they want them to enroll in public school. I think that that's what that is about.
Yeah. So there's already a religious exemption that families can go down to the Department of Health and receive. And for a lot of families, the religious exemption is in many ways a conscientious or a philosophical exemption, which they can already receive. So I'm not sure that there's truly a need for it, but... if that's what the families choose to do, then that will be their decision. What concerns a lot of us is the idea that I cannot tell you as a patient in my practice that I have to take you whether you are vaccinated or not. And the concern is making sure that all the people around in my office are also not going to be
protected,
put at risk by your child.
So. Now, what about that? I mean, are there I realize you're an academic physician and a professor, but to your knowledge, based on your work with the American Academy of Pediatrics, are there private practices now that are saying we will not accept patients who are not vaccinated?
Yes.
And is that something that would be affected by this law?
Yeah, they would be required to take all children regardless of their vaccine status. And that goes, you know, we should be allowed to have our own consciences and our own moral and ethics based upon our scientific knowledge and our medical practice as to what we think keeps not just your child safe, but all the people around you. The, you know, again, the same adults, staff, nurses, et cetera, who would be exposed to your child who is not vaccinated.
And other patients who may be compromised, mm-hmm. whose health may be compromised. You know, it's interesting that, you know, these new laws will require, you know, the parent's position to be paramount, but the physicians and the physicians' offices' own positions seem to be ignored mm-hmm. in this new world, in these new laws.
Right. And parents should have the right to make decisions for their children. But as a physician, we should have the right to decide what will be safest, not just for your child, but for people around them as well.
Okay, I have a question here from one of our email correspondents who says, good morning, penicillin allergy sufferer here. Our primary care practitioners being individual specific enough for a patient's allergies to different medicine ingredients? I mean, I don't know. I've been at a lot of doctors lately, and they always ask, do you have any medication mm-hmm. allergies?
Yes.
Always. But yes. He may be referring to different medicines ingredients. I mean, of course, nobody knows if they have an allergy to a particular thing until they're exposed to it and they respond, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So I know we do ask every time, you know, do you have any allergies to medicines, other allergies, and we do our best to not put you at risk.
Yeah.
Of having an allergic reaction.
Yeah, I know. I've noticed that, you know, every single medication, I mean, medical admission form in a doctor's mm-hmm. office asks about allergies to medication. Okay,
correct.
Going back to this new Florida law that's proposed, it is going to eliminate mandates. So some mandates are in state rules
correct.
That are changeable by the health department, but others are in state law that require legislative action.
Correct.
For school entry, for example, currently school entry requires a kid to be vaccinated for polio, MMR, tetanus, et cetera, a number of vaccines. But always these exemptions for religious exemption, for example, they currently exist.
Yes.
You know, so,
yes.
But the administration now in Florida aims to remove all mandates. So, Latipo, the Surgeon General, can remove those that are not a matter of law, but the legislature has to pass a law for the statutory mandates to be removed.
Correct. So there are four vaccines that are solely, that are not legislatively required right now. Hepatitis B, chickenpox, H flu meningitis, and pneumococcal. And those are the ones that are currently being recommended by the Department of Health to be taken off of the required school entry because the other ones so far are still in statute. But this other law...
These proposals. Senate Bill 1756 and House Bill 917 are allegedly going to remove those additional
potentially,
mandates.
Potentially,
yes. Yeah, potentially. And again, I will say, if you have a position on this out in listener land, you know what to do. You need to contact
your
representatives... Your House and Senate representatives and tell them what your position is on these particular bills because they're moving through the legislature right now. As you mm-hmm. know, the legislature opened yesterday.
Correct.
And they're do the professional organizations have a position on this legislation?
Yes, a lot of the professional organizations have come out against this. We believe that everybody should be getting vaccinated. And so it's the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Florida Medical Association. I can list several others. And not just medical organizations, the educators are against this change.
The teachers, yeah.
The teachers, there yeah. are parents who are against this. You know, their children who would not be able to attend school if they were going to be exposed to all these other children who are potentially going to make them sick.
Right. Okay, now, you know, some states have defied this new world, the new CDC guidelines. For example, there's at least 17 states, including California, New York, and Washington, that have rejected the new CDC guidance, and they've stated that they will continue to follow the broader vaccination schedules that were previously recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics. So, you know, this is not a universal thing throughout the United States.
Not at all.
Florida's going it, you know, not necessarily alone, but pretty much, are we alone in this?
We're one of the first, and we're, you know, the concern is, are we going to be the suggested idea for other states as well to follow?
Well, you know, and the other thing that I think people would need to know is that CDC guidance is highly influential for insurance coverage and regional policy. It doesn't carry the weight of law, and so individual states maintain the authority to set their own vaccine mandates for schools. But what's going to happen in Florida if Florida removes these vaccine mandates? What's going to happen to people whose kids are insured by private insurance, for example?
We don't know yet. We're being told as of now they're all going to continue to pay for them, but will that continue? We have no idea.
So you could presumably go to your physician as someone who wants your kids vaccinated and be told that we're happy to vaccinate you, but it won't be covered by your insurance.
Correct. And a lot of the vaccines are not cheap. We've looked into that, and they can cost a lot of money for families. Still less expensive than, you know, hospitalization for some of these diseases, but, you know, it should be a right as part of your health insurance that you are able to still get all the vaccines.
And of course, with the new CDC guidelines, we should be concerned about Medicaid and, you know, being required to pay for vaccines as well, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that's another issue for people who can't afford insurance to be get private insurance. They're on Medicaid or some alternative Florida Kid Care type thing.
Right, healthy kids.
Yeah, healthy kids. Yeah, they may not be able to get those vaccines paid for.
We don't know yet.
So still, if you want your kids vaccinated, please proceed, right?
Yes.
Go get them vaccinated.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. We're running out of time here. Very quickly, I want to ask you about one other thing. Recently, we've been warned that the Florida Health Department found heavy metals and other contaminants in over a dozen baby formula samples. These are substances that can pose real health risks, particularly for infants and young children. What have you learned about that?
So the guidelines that have come out, there's a scorecard that you can find online for a lot of these different vaccines.
Yeah, you can find the results of these testings at exposingfoodtoxins.com/initiatives.
Right. But so far, yeah, I've been doing this for almost 30 years. I've never had a child come in poisoned from any of these additives that they're worried about. But I've had lots of children come in who have been underweight because they couldn't get formula. So they're still very safe. They're still FDA approved. And until someone actually shows us the data that they used to make these recommendations, which they have not, we're going to continue to recommend all these different formulations.
These baby formulas.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So, okay. So if you still have concerns about that testing, you can find the results of which products had contaminants that were found to exceed the maximum daily levels determined by the U.S. EPA and Food and Drug Administration at exposingfoodtoxins.com/initiatives. Okay, that's really all we have time for, my friends. I am so grateful to Dr. Jennifer Takagishi for giving us her time to discuss vaccines and children's health with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We really appreciate all the information that you gave us. If you, in listener land, came in late and missed any of the show, remember, you can always find the show in the archives on Thursday at WMNF.org/midpoint or as a WMNF Midpoint podcast, usually on Friday from Spotify or Apple Music. Thanks always to our WMNF production volunteers, too, Jessica Green and Barbara Fling. And thanks to you, our listeners, for your continued support of your community radio station, WMNF. Now, Duncan is back with Talking Animals next after the NPR News on WMNF Tampa. And we are out. I think. All right. So we got some music or something?
Yes.
I'm
not hearing. I'm not hearing.